Welcome to another awesome episode of the Foodie Flashback, the podcast where we talk about food, food-related memories, and just everything that goes with it with a guest. And my guest today is someone, well, you might have heard of. Like, I mean, he's been on a bunch of podcasts. He's been on, like, he's been an author on the web, stuff like that. Not these days. I don't remember. Like, I don't think you're doing any writing.
Not actively publishing anywhere. But thank you for remembering, since it was several years ago.
It has been a while.
Regularly contributing.
And I've known you for a while. So my guest today is Mike Rose. Formerly media, Cylon Media Sensation. That's what I remember about you. you've been around in like podcasts. I mean, you have a couple of podcasts still, or at least one that I do remember that you're doing.
Yep. I still have one. So I'm, folks who are among your listeners may remember, the unofficial Apple weblog and late lamented unofficial Apple weblog, TUAW.com. Mm-hmm. And we had a live Sunday night show called The Talkcast, which was on TalkShoe. And it was a live call-in show, mm-hmm. About all things Apple for actually quite a few years. It was going on for a long while, then shut down along with a few months before the blog itself closed. Yeah. But one of the things that emerged from that show was my friendship with Kelly Gamont, who was my co-host on the Talkcast. And then we decided we weren't done podcasting. So as soon as the Talkcast was over, she and I started a show called The After Show, mm-hmm. which is at aftershowpodcast.com. Turns out there's a lot of podcasts named The After Show, mostly having to do with television or sports. Ours is peripherally about television, not really about, well, actually a little bit about sports
sometimes.
Too. But largely about technology and culture. Mm-hmm. And so again, it's aftershowpodcast.com. We're on Twitter at @the_aftershow. And in our most recent episode, Kelly revealed to me that over the decade plus that we've known each other, for most of that time, I've been pronouncing her name wrong. It is not Guimont or Guimont, as it would be if it's in French, but it's Gamont. The UI is silent. As a good UI should be. You don't want it beeping at you or making little
true.
Noises.
No
so it's a good mnemonic for me. It's like the UI is silent. Of course it is. It's a visual user interface, not mm-hmm. an audible user interface.
No.
But yes, we have a great time doing the show. And I am not infrequently heard on Chuck Joyner's Mac Voices, mm-hmm. Mac Voices Live. I've been a guest there over the years. And most recently, I've been one of the rotating guests on Ken Ray's In a Few Minutes, which mm-hmm. is his daily show that accompanies macOS Ken. Yeah. And that's a lot of fun. So we just recorded a fun 15 years in the past, 15 years in the future show this week.
Ooh.
So
I will have to listen to that. All the shows you mentioned are like actually my favorites. I like Ken. I like Chuck. Like, I mean, I do I do BTN shows with Chuck and so on. It's you've been on my list. Let's put it this way.
Glad to be here.
Happy to have you. We do know each other from the tour days. Mm-hmm. We met once, I think. I don't remember whether it was more than that, but we met at Macworld. That I do remember. But to my knowledge, we have never talked about food. And I don't know, have you ever talked about food on a podcast?
Not deliberately that I can recall. I don't think I've certainly never been on a food-related podcast. I know many, many food podcasters, including one of the several podcast marriages that I know of. Marissa McClellan, who is the Food in Jars podcaster, and who's also the spouse of Scott McNulty, who was one of my predecessors at TUAW as an editor. There's several other podcasting marriages I can think of. The other one that comes to mind is Christina Warren and Grant Robertson, who met when they were blogging and podcasting at Download Squad. Mm-hmm. But as far as food is concerned, yes, Marissa is the main food podcaster I know about. I've never been on her show. And no, never been on a food podcast. So
you've done a couple of Instagrams though. Like I remember watching you once, like cooking. I don't remember
I did one Instagram live of, I don't know what prompted me to do it. I was spatchcocking and roasting a chicken.
Yeah.
And I don't know what made me think, what, maybe this would be interesting content, but I did an Instagram live of spatchcocking a chicken. Mm-hmm. And I think many of my friends thought I had lost my mind. Certainly my children did. But it turned out really good, by
it
the
was
way.
Really good.
Goddess roast chicken. I think I did take a picture of it after it was done. Oh my God, so delicious. But yeah, that's the only, like there's a Facebook group I'm a member of called What's for Dinner, which is usually just photographs of what people made for dinner. And I'm fond of food Instagram. I have friends who are restaurateurs and bar owners, and I'm always curious about how they make those choices. One of my oldest friends is the CEO of Mouth, which is a US-based artisanal gift website. So mouth.com, if you're looking for candied bacon or, you know, special ice cube molds or whatever, it's all food related gifts. And Nancy is the CEO, one of the co-founders and the CEO. And I'm always amazed by how effective food photography and food writing is when you can't taste it.
Yeah, like you, it's
the difference between something like Great British Bake Off and Project Runway, as in terms of television. Like Project Runway, you can see the clothing. Like most of the experience of that clothing is going to be from the perspective of someone who's looking at it, not the person who's wearing it or sewing it. So you get like 90% of the experience of that piece of clothing. You get less than 25% of the experience of that cream puff or that, you know, that that loaf of challah, but it's still a compelling narrative and compelling experience because there's so much emotion wrapped up in that thing that's been created.
The interesting thing is really about like those, I would say most cooking shows, that you can look at it and you can imagine eating it.
Depends what they're cooking, but yeah, I mean, and I've been a fan. I mean, I'm a big fan of cooking shows. I'm an Alton Brown fan. I'm a Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives fan. I love barbecue shows. You know, I like, and Anthony Bourdain. I like food TV. Like television about food is great. My wife would say that I consume far more food media than I produce food in the cooking process, which is fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I love to eat. I like to cook. And I definitely like to watch things about food and listen to things about food.
We'll have to talk about those barbecue shows. but like, actually that's a pretty good lead into my usual two questions. I always like to ask, like, and it's been really interesting to see different perspectives on this topic. I like to ask my guests what their definition of a foodie is and whether they consider themselves one. So I'm wondering about you.
The definition of a foodie. You know, that's a tough one. I mean, I think in my upbringing or in my growing up, a foodie was someone who, it had a connotation of being a snob about food, or being a little bit, you know, putting on airs and having an affect about food. And I've changed that a little bit over time, because now I think of it more as someone who finds a sense of adventure and takes delight in food, even if it's if it's simple or uncomplicated or unsophisticated. But, you know, having a sense of adventure, an adventurous palate, I think that's the fundamental definition of being a foodie. And what I am proud of is not necessarily my own enthusiasm for fine dining or for adventurous cuisines, although I feel like I have that, but that my kids are both, have both grown up to have reasonably adventurous palates and to be people who are not afraid to try new foods and new things.
That's not an easy thing. That's difficult to get there.
Well, I mean, a lot of people say, well, that's sort of inevitable if you're talking about kids growing up in New York City, which mine have. But I don't think that's automatic. I think you have to put in a little bit of energy, a little bit of intentionality into that. And I think we did. So I'm really glad that they both are willing to try new things and are willing to have adventurous palates and to be forthright about what they like and what they don't like, which they certainly are.
Yeah. I mean, just growing up in that environment, I don't think helps that much because it can also just repel you. I mean, either you never try it because like it is foreign to you and you just see it and you're like, oh, I don't want to deal with that. Or it repels you because it's like, you just have too many options and you're just like, it's like the issue with choice. Like you're sometimes growing up in an environment like that, you're like, okay, I just want to deal with the things I know because the world is difficult enough as it is.
Right. So, I don't need new things to focus on because I've got enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably difficult if you're growing up in, like, I don't know. I talked to Brett about Minnesota. If you're growing up there where there is not too much around, especially in the more rural areas, and you don't get exposed to, I don't know, Mexican or Chinese or whatever, like maybe there's a pizza place like a couple miles away and that's about as far as it goes. Sure, that's more difficult for you to develop that curiosity. But as I said, like just growing up in that environment doesn't mean you automatically get more excited about it.
Yeah.
So, we still haven't established, do you consider yourself one?
Right. Oh, we were defining it and, wow. I guess I do. I mean, I certainly have a lot of interest in the culinary domain. I'm very curious about it. I'm also like a kitchen gadget person. So it's like the Instant Pot and the sous vide are coming up. And I love my sous vide. I think it's amazing. It's actually kind of astonishing how good stuff can come out when you use it. But I don't have necessarily really complex tastes, but I love the experience of trying something new and something unfamiliar. I will say that for my wife's birthday year before last, so this would have been October of 2019, I guess. Yeah. We went, one of my children was out of the country. So it was just the three of us, my younger daughter and my wife and I, and we went and I didn't know what we were going to do. I didn't have a plan. And I heard about a restaurant in New York, in Brooklyn, in Prospect Heights called Honey Badger, which was a wild to table, I think still is a wild to table restaurant, where the restaurant, which was run by a husband and wife, worked with their own farm and with foragers and with hunters to like bring not only seasonal produce, but wild fruits and nuts and wild game and, you know, indigenous or heritage foods of the Northeast to the table in Brooklyn. And I thought, wow, this seems really cool. I don't spend a lot of time hunting down prefix places and, but I was like, this seems really cool. So we ended up going on a Tuesday night and turned out it's a tiny place. It's maybe six or seven tables, but we were the only people there.
Wow.
So it's the husband and wife and their daughter, who was maybe 9 or 10, was sitting doing her homework at the counter. And then the two of them were cooking and serving and coming and checking and explaining. It's like, okay, this is a ground chestnut mousse. And, you know, this, and younger daughter doesn't like mushrooms, so they avoided using mushrooms in one of the dishes and substituted a different, like they made gnocchi for that. But it was extraordinary. It was just like one of those bizarre, amazing experiences.
Sounds amazing.
And it's really cool. And you know, hopefully if they're back post pandemic, you should definitely check it out. Honey Badger. But the point being that I don't always seek out those experiences, but if I have the chance to do that or go to, you know, another sort of peak dining moment was going to Morimoto in Philadelphia, when it not too long after it opened and it was, and, Matsuhara Morimoto was there and was running the kitchen at that point. And that was just like, oh my God, such a thrill. And there's a, as I've gotten older and I've gotten to know more professional chefs and more people involved in the industry, being able to be sort of a part of their experience is really cool too. So this year for my wife's birthday, speaking of, it's the Heidi's birthday show. So last year in 2019, we went to Honey Badger. In 2020, obviously we couldn't do that, but she said she wanted two things for her birthday since we couldn't have a big, you know, 50th birthday celebration. And one of them was a private concert from her favorite musician, Dar Williams, which we did get, a private Zoom concert, which was amazing. And the other was a, you know, private dinner cooked by her favorite chef, who is a friend of ours named Allison Plummer. And Allison has had a really amazing career. She's stepped back from the restaurant industry for any number of reasons, but had an amazing career at a couple places in Brooklyn, Lot 2, which is our favorite sort of neighborhood local place. And then at the Red Hook Tavern, which opened up a couple years ago and immediately shot to the top of everybody's, you know, must visits, best burger in New York.
I've heard about both of them. So
they're both really good. Like they were both amazing. And so Allison and we followed her, you know, we became friends with her because we were regulars. And then Heidi invited her to come and take the commission of doing a private dinner. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. But it's like, I wouldn't think of that as the first thing I would do, but it's spectacular to be able to do it. The third person or the other person I was thinking of is Patty Jackson, who is a friend of mine, the husband of an old friend. And excuse me, the wife of an old friend. Her husband is our old friend. And Patty, for several years had a restaurant in Williamsburg, which was also a prefix restaurant called Delaware and Hudson, which was all about the cuisine of the Appalachians and the Baltimore and Maryland and the Mid-Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And at Delaware and Hudson, it was like she had crab cakes and she had scrapple and she had an amazing, amazing prefix dinner and she had amazing brunch. And we were sort of invested in her success and really excited about being part of that and being sort of insiders. Yeah. And then she got a Michelin star and it was like, whoa, this is beyond just like we're excited for our friend. This is a real thing.
Yeah.
So that was spectacular, and that was a wonderful. It's a wonderful feeling to feel that you know about a place that's really special, but that also you're invested in the success of it in a way that's personal.
And about the people behind it. I mean, it's not about the place. It's also about the people that work there, and I can put everything they have in it, like their heart and their souls, and like blood, sweat, and tears, and everything. So I've had that same experience. There was like in Koblenz, there was a chef, really young, like I want to say mid to late, probably late 20s at that point. And he had worked for some Michelin star like chefs and whatever. And he opened up a teeny tiny restaurant, like maybe 10 tables. It was very special. Probably too special for the area because the people there are not interested too much in that. But like we went there a couple of times and he was like really, really nice. And like he got a star within 6 months, I think, which wasn't expected. Like he thought, I mean, it would be a couple of years probably, like learning everything and building on it and whatever, like 6 months. Wow. And it was super exciting for him. Unfortunately, his like he had a partner, like another chef.
Right.
And yeah, as an investor, he shut it down.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, it was unfortunate that one.
That's one of the things I do love about traveling is that finding those places mm-hmm. that are you know, provide a degree of specialization or are a little bit off the beaten path. I know when this is now years and years ago, maybe 10 years ago, who mm-hmm. knows? But we were in Berlin and somebody, I guess it was Heidi, wanted Maultaschen.
Mm-hmm.
And we found like the Schwäbische restaurant, you know, mm-hmm. off in the, you know, not in the Centrum, like off on
hard enough
to
find in Berlin, probably, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it was so good. Like, and I was like, I mean, it's funny. It almost is cliche, but it's like, if you want to experience the home cooking mm-hmm. or the home cooking similarities of whatever culture, whatever country you're in, find the dumplings.
Mm-hmm.
Like just find the dumplings.
It's true.
Because yeah. There's a dumpling in every culture.
Yeah.
So go have the dumplings. Like, okay, great. Now I can explore out from here.
Mm-hmm.
But for, I imagine many of your listeners probably know what Maultaschen are, but they're,
I don't know.
they're not too doughy. They're like ravioli, and they have usually with onion and cheese mm-hmm. and they're super delicious. Like,
they are.
They're really tasty. But there's a, you know, having spent quite a bit of time in Germany over the years, that there are the regional experience of German cuisine has crept into my mm-hmm. foodiness. So now I'll say, oh, well, you know, if we're going to a Krug, you know, then I'm going to have, then I'll have Eisbein or something. Mm-hmm. Like I'll go a little out on a limb. Or, you know, if we're in Lippe in Nordrhein-Westfalen, it's like, well, you have to go someplace for Pickert, the potato pancakes. Cause that's also a traditional food of my wife's childhood. Cause of her mother coming from Germany. But I love the fact now that we, you know, as hard as it is right now, we still live four blocks from an amazing, Austrian cafe, bar mm-hmm. and cafe, where we're friends with the owners. And it's, it's spectacular. It's just like
yeah.
to be able to go and have cucumber salad that tastes like proper Austrian or German cucumber salad mm-hmm. to have a bratwurst and a pretzel and a pills and be like, okay, this is correct. Like this is done the way I talk about there's stretching your expectations. And there's also the importance of meeting your expectations. Mm-hmm. And it's, being able to have Werkstatt around the corner is a source of enormous comfort and deliciousness. So good.
Yeah, I think you've posted a couple of photos there, and I've seen the menu, and I'm like, yeah, that. I mean, there were like one or two items, and I was like, I'm not so sure about that. Like whether you would actually find that in Germany, but like it looked legit. Like it looked like something that you would find in like whatever Frankfurt or like that area yeah. probably.
Well, it's definitely Austrian, and it's definitely not German and specifically mm-hmm. Austrian, but there's obviously enough. I mean, Well, that's actually I was going to say something about Canadian cuisine and U.S. cuisine, but that's totally unfair because they actually those have a lot of differentiation. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of similarities between Austria.
Yeah, there's
and
a lot of similarities. So. Like what I'll tell you what we don't have near us is a good poutine place, and that makes me sad.
Oh yeah.
It's just go a ways for good poutine. but yeah, I mean I feel like I have a number of home cuisines, mm-hmm. like home cuisines culturally or home cuisines in terms of my life experience. And I'm really happy about that. Like it makes me happy to have that experience.
Yeah, definitely. That's something I want to jump into a little bit because I mean, one, I know that you spent some time in Germany, yep. and it's definitely a cuisine I mean, I've talked to one person on Foodie Flashback. She was from Germany. But other than that, we haven't explored that yet. And I would like, I would be interested to see like your how you ended up in Germany and your food experience around that. Like, what did you experience? What did you take from there? I mean, we've heard already a little bit, but like, you know, Moldhaschen and
how I ended up there is a law. Well, could be a short story, could be a long story, but I'll give you the medium short version. So actually, my grandparents, my mother's parents, left Germany in the 1930s. I'm Jewish. My family is Jewish, and my grandparents were very fortunate to leave the country when they did, and come to the States. But that, you know, obviously that is a fraught that's a fraught relationship with mm-hmm. the German culture and the German country. But when I was growing up, and I had the choice when I started junior high to choose a language I was going to study. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was French, Spanish, Latin, or German. I was like, well, why not study German? Because that'll be great. My grandmother was still living at the time. I said, mm-hmm. well, I can speak German with my grandmother, and that'll be awesome. So, fun fact, I am among the world's worst language students. come to discover. And my grandmother, who was, you know, a German expat of a certain age, mm-hmm. had zero patience with my inability to speak proper German.
I think that's a German thing.
It's a very German thing. Well, at the time, I think today, interestingly, my experiences in the country have been quite different, and the people are very enthusiastic when you make the attempt. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I didn't spend a lot of time speaking German with my grandmother. I didn't spend a lot of time speaking German with my mother or my father, both of whom did speak it. But like I took 4 years of German. I was really bad at it. I mean, I learned some, mm-hmm. but I didn't really use it. And I thought after 4 years, like, all right, I'm never going to use this again. Then I went to college. In college, I met a young woman. Her family, specifically her mother, was German. Her mother was the only one of five children who had emigrated. Mm-hmm. So all of the extended family, the aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents, were all in Germany, specifically in Lippe, mm-hmm. in Nordrhein-Westfalen. So in the northwest part of the country, a place with not only regional cuisine,
yep.
but also a regional accent,
yes,
which becomes relevant. So once Heidi and I met and started dating, it was very early on in our relationship where we ended up going to Germany together on vacation. And at that point, neither of us spoke the language worth a darn. So every place we went, any conversation we had to have by committee. So her mm-hmm. grandmother would ask us something. We would sort of converse, like, what do you think she said? I think she asked us if we want tea. And so we would agree and decide what we mm-hmm. wanted to say back. But we traveled around the whole country, visited all the family. And that was in May of 1990, so almost 31 years ago now. Yeah. And we've been married for 21 years, and we have two children, and yada, yada, yada. So almost unintentionally, my relationship with Germany and German culture is very, very different than what mm-hmm. it might have been if not for the fact that I married into a half-German family. Coming from a half-German family, very different kind of half-German family, I married into another half-German family with a vibrant and dynamic connection to the Heimatland. Mm-hmm. So that's my connection to Germany. Mm-hmm. I've been there for 13 or 14 times. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's also like, are they all like in the same area, like a Lippe area, or is the family like this, like spread across Germany?
Well, now they're reasonably distributed. I mean, mm-hmm. I think in 1990, more of them were local, but now there's an aunt and uncle who are in Lemgo, which is mm-hmm. the closest to where my mother-in-law grew up. My mother-in-law grew up in a town called Laga.
Oh, yeah.
And for Germans, you know Laga,
well,
really?
I have family in that area in general, so yeah.
Okay, you are literally the only person who has ever known where Laga is. That's okay. So mm-hmm. for the non-German speakers listening to the podcast, Laga also is a word meaning location. Mm-hmm. So it's a town called Place. It's not very big.
Nope, it's tiny.
It's tiny, but it's lovely, mm-hmm. and it's located in a very lovely part of the country. So there's a lot, there are... The Externsteine, which are these enormous mm-hmm. geological formations nearby, which are fun to climb on. There's the Hermannsdenkmal, which is a enormous sort of the Statue of Liberty-esque yep. statue, which has some interesting and unfortunate nationalist connotations, but it's of the Germanic, the leader of the Germanic tribes who turned back the Romans, I believe, or the, yes. I don't know if it's the barbarians. So it's no, the Romans.
It was the Romans, actually. Yeah. I said, my family is actually not too far away in Minden. I don't know whether you've heard about
Minden.
That.
I do know roughly where Minden is.
That's where my grandpa and my grandma used to live. So I know that area.
Well, I had a colleague once, Petra Gruger, and I mentioned something about the family coming from Laga, and she said, and so she had burst out, she said, Laga, Hermannsdenkmal. I was like, where are you from? She said, Paderborn. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. So right around the corner. Somewhere, I wish we still had the poster. All we have is a photograph of this poster, but there was an advertisement for when the airport in Paderborn started running flights to the US. Mm-hmm. And it was a picture of the Hermann and the Statue of Liberty sort of facing one another.
Okay.
And it said, Niva ditante in America so na. Never was your aunt in America so nearby. And it was amazing. That's it was funny. Great marketing. It was like, this is fantastic.
Yeah, that's funny.
So we have a photograph of that. Anyway, so Patrice knows where this is, but other folks may not. The rest of the family is now, there's an aunt and uncle in Lemgo. There's an aunt and uncle in Bremen. Mm-hmm. There's an aunt and uncle in Cuxhaven on the North Sea, which mm-hmm. is beautiful and fun to visit. There's cousins in Hanover, in Hamburg, I think there's a cousin in Frankfurt, mm-hmm. But they're all, and for a long time we had family in Berlin, and then the family in Berlin moved back to Hamburg. So we don't have family in Berlin anymore, but it's mostly in the,
like Western, in the Northwestern.
Mm-hmm. Hanover, there's one set of cousins in Hanover. And we've had, you know, from time to time, we've had cousins actually here with us. We had Heidi's cousin living with us for a few months. I want to say this was 3 years ago, which was great. And mm-hmm. you know, back to the point I made earlier about the regional cuisine and the regional accent. When I arrived in Germany, and most of the time I've spent in Germany, I've spent it largely around folks from this same geographical area. Mm-hmm. So imagine you came to the U.S. and you spent all your time with people who lived in Western Pennsylvania.
Yep.
Your English would start to sound like the English spoken in Western Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. When I speak German with native German speakers, they say, your German is fantastic. I say, it's really not. It's actually quite bad. And my comprehension is crappy. And like my vocabulary is not great.
It's not too bad.
But what you're responding to, what your ear is telling you, is not that I speak German well. It's that I sound like I am from someplace. I don't sound like I'm from Deutsche Welle. I don't sound mm-hmm. like I'm from the TV, like BBC English or like PBS NewsHour English in the US. Someone who talks like that doesn't sound like they're from a real place.
Mm-hmm. True.
I sound vaguely like I might be from, you know, Detmold.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great, but it's actually a miscue. Like native German speakers hear it. Well, it makes them think I speak excellent German, but it breaks down over time. So,
yeah, but that's so funny because that's something I've experienced. So I have a friend in Phoenix.
Yes.
She's from Croatia originally, grew up in Germany and has been living in the US for, I don't know, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
She has three passports.
Wow.
She grew up literally in the same city as my dad. And when she speaks German, I can tell. She hasn't spoken German in like 20 years. But whenever she does, I'm like, oh yeah, I know where you're from. Like, I didn't know. And she started talking. I'm like, I know where you're from. And she's like, how? And I'm like, I know exactly where you're from.
You can pinpoint it.
Yeah.
And that's, it's amazing too, because there are some many stories I'll tell them because it's unlikely any of my German relatives are going to hear this. One of the grandson of Gerhard and Angelika had two grandfathers named Gerhard because mm-hmm. a lot of German men of that generation were named Gerhard. And first of all, he called one of them Opa, mm-hmm. and the other one, Opa.
Oh, yeah.
which is the Lippish pronunciation. Mm-hmm. And then it was the it was also that it was Gerhard or Gerhard, which is exaggerated, but there's
exactly,
a but there's
that's a,
there's
a very accent.
Yeah. So my Lippish accent is there and it doesn't work if you're told about it ahead of time. That's mm-hmm. the trick. You have to be immersed in it for years and then someone tells you, "Oh, by the way, you speak with a Lippish accent." Like, I don't know what you're talking about. But true enough, mm-hmm. there are these you know, the phonemes that go in different directions. And I think there's a website or there's a New York Times quiz that asks you as a, mm-hmm. in the US, yeah. how do you pronounce, what do you say for this word? Or how, does this, like when you say this, does it rhyme mm-hmm. with A or rhyme with B? And it will pinpoint you to like one side of the Ohio River Valley or the other, like well, one part of a particular yeah. state.
In some places, it can even pinpoint to you to what part of the city you grew up in.
Like right, in which is
Phoenix,
creepy.
In Phoenix, for example, it can tell you whether you're from Glendale or from Phoenix, like Phoenix Valley. Like it goes into depth detail sometimes. It's really
super creepy.
Well, it was really funny. I took that quiz. I mean, this is not a language podcast, but it doesn't matter.
but isn't
I took
it,
that
isn't
quiz,
really?
And I ended up like in the like Phoenix, California area. Like my accent. I'm like, yeah, that makes total sense because that's most people I interact with are from that area. So I just picked that up automatically.
Yeah, and that's what happened to me with German. And I guess also with German food. So, you know, to come back to the things that are culturally communicated, mm-hmm. language, posture, social interactions, food. My experience of German food really started in Westphalia. Mm-hmm. And so specifically in Lippe. Yeah. And so, you know, again, for when you think about German cuisine, it's got broad, you know, sort of geographical contours, but it also has these very specific local or hyper-local cuisines. Yeah. So in Lippe, we've got to cook. I'll grab it at the end of the show and show it to you because I know you want to see it. It's a book called Oma's Rezepte. Uh-huh. But it's all specific stuff to this to this area. I think many of the relatives did not wish to inflict that on me necessarily, or they felt it's country cooking, like it's mm-hmm. it's not considered cosmopolitan or
definitely isn't.
Foodie highfalutin foodie cooking, but it's very good. It's very mm-hmm. hearty and very tasty. And so the signature dish of the region, which I mentioned earlier, is Pickert, which is a sort of farmhand pancake, maybe. Mm-hmm. Made in the morning, designed to be cooked in the morning to be eaten in the afternoon. So something that you could take out with you into the fields with you. Mm-hmm. And it's a leavened potato pancake, a yeasty potato pancake, very tasty and often served with, sometimes with Metwurst, but often with Rubenkraut, mm-hmm. which is the sugar beet syrup, which is delicious. It goes really good on vanilla ice cream.
I do remember that. Now that you mentioned that, my grandma used to have that.
Right. I'm sure we have some in the cabinet because it's like honey. It very rarely, it doesn't, I mean, honey never goes bad. Rubenkraut, I know, can last for years.
Forever.
And in fact, you know, talking about family there, Uncle Gerhard, who I mentioned, was a young child during the Second World War. And he remembers being sent by his mother to the man in the village who was cooking down the sugar beets mm-hmm. for Rubenkraut and to bring the beets that they had in their garden and to get back the jar mm-hmm. of Rubenkraut. So
yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my mm-hmm. original connection to German food. Of course, it's broadened over the years. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of like German street food and like the, you know, averse to go kind of like mm-hmm. if you take me to a place where there's many food trucks or stands, this is true in Chelsea Market in New York. If you take me to that place, like, okay, Mike, close your eyes, spin around, point to what you want. I will almost inevitably end up at the Bratwurst stand. And I'm very happy. I'm very happy when I do. It just draws me in. I don't mm-hmm. know why.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that you see all around the world. It's meat in some shape, like tube shape. like it can be completely different. It can like with a casing, without a casing, but it's some sort of meat in that shape you will find in a lot of places. I mean, Germany is known for that, I think, to some extent. Like, especially certain regions, at least, like Berlin, like, and then like Nuremberg area, definitely like Nürnberger, Frankfurt, obviously, Frankfurter. But it's, you will see that in so many places, and it's so interesting to discover that.
Yeah.
What else do you remember food-wise from Germany? Like, I mean, we talked about the Lippe region, but you said you traveled a little bit, so.
I love Berlin. I love Berlin so much. I love Berlin. Is the, you know, having grown up in New York City, I don't know how many of your listeners have the experience of growing up in a big city and then finding it sometimes hard to be comfortable other places, mm-hmm. or feeling like other places are too small or too quiet. The first time I went to Berlin, I was like, oh yeah. This is it. This is good. And I've never had a bad time in Berlin. I love Berlin. I love how funky it is. I just love it. And I love the cultural experience of it, and I love the food experience of it. So really, we not infrequently find ourselves one evening while we're in Berlin sort of aimlessly wandering around the streets near the Kaiser Wilhelm Gedächtniskirche, mm-hmm. so sort of like right near that central square. And there's, for those who don't know Berlin, it's the ruined church and also the modern church are both in the center of this big square. And then there's skateboarders, mm-hmm. you know, all over on one side, and there's a big plaza. But then the streets radiate out in rays, in a circular pattern, as opposed to being on a grid. And literally any of those streets you walk down, you're going to pass a lot of tourist joints and restaurants catering to the tourist trade, which we don't mind because we have one place there that I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's like Berlin 2 or something. It's like not a very distinctive name, but we love it. And it's just like, you know, hearty and delightful. So the Berlin dining experience, I really like. When we're in Cuxhaven, we always are eating fish. Mm-hmm. And that's totally great as well. And then it's a lot of home cooking. My Uncle Gerhard loves to grill. He has a cowboy style swinging grill that goes over a campfire. So he'll make, pork cutlets there. The first time he met me, again, so we're talking like 1990, well, maybe not 1990, but maybe the next visit. Mm-hmm. He went out of his way to get, I think, turkey cutlets, because he's like, well, I don't want to make Mike, you know, I'm not sure Mike eats pork. And I was like, well, I do. So it's fine, but it's very thoughtful of you to think about it. The other primary memory, and so many of these are associated with family, is with Heidi's uncle Hans-Jürgen and Aunt Ruth, who currently live in Bremen and used to live in a tiny town called Barnstorf. Hans-Jürgen is a winophile and has an impressive wine cellar and wine mm-hmm. collection. So inevitably, you know, the first night, first day we would be with them in the evening, he'd say, so what are we drinking? And he'd say, well, you know, say, what do you like? What are you in the mood for? And we're like, oh, you know, maybe a Burgundy or a Malbec. He's like, ooh. And he would disappear and he'd come back with like four bottles. And I mean, we get so plastered. In fairness, we got plastered everywhere we went. And again, I say this knowing it is highly unlikely that my family will hear this. My wife's family, this is another piece of like going to the same place over and over again, mm-hmm. but also going to be with the same people over and over again. I gained the experience after having gone to a couple of weddings and silver anniversaries with my wife's extended family that they're like, you had to pace yourself because you did start doing your liver exercises a mm-hmm. month in advance.
Yep.
And I thought, this seems like, I don't know how they do it. And a German wedding, you know, the celebration will go all night long. And at, mm-hmm. you know, 2 a.m, there's trays being passed of Aquavit yep. and Jägermeister. It's like, what, how am I supposed to make it to breakfast at this pace?
You don't.
It was insane.
It is typical for that area, to be fair. Like, it's not, well, you will not experience the same thing like in other parts.
This is what I was trying to figure out. So mm-hmm. then some years into this, my Heidi's cousin Klaus was getting married, or met a woman, and Anna, who's now his wife, and she's amazing and delightful. And she's from Eckernförde, mm-hmm. near the border with Denmark. So she's not from Lippe, and she was not part of, she's obviously marrying into the family. So at one point I said, Anna, I got to ask you, like, I've 10 years with these people. Is it all Germans who drink like this, or are they exceptional in this regard? And she looked at me and she said, I have never met people who drink like this. I was like, well, that's a huge relief, because mm-hmm. I needed somebody who could come in from sort of the outside of the family and give me an unvarnished take on it. So the booze is a big, big part of that food and drink, heavy on the drink experience with my wife's family.
It definitely is. I mean, I have like an uncle in like the Bremen area, Oldenburg. And mm-hmm. like, I remember I think it was his 60th birthday. We drank all night. Like, there was, I mean, they put out alcohol like after midnight. They were dancing until like 6 a.m. And they're, as I said, at 60. Like, it's not like other people you would expect at that age. You're like, oh, maybe like go to bed at 10 p.m. Like, that's kind of a stereotype. No.
No.
They're drinking, no, they're partying. Like, that's that region. Like,
well, the last family wedding we went to, I wish I could remember the name of the town. I'll have to look it up. But we were at a castle. Mm-hmm. And it was very much that, you know, like, at 2 a.m. it was, the DJ was really just getting started. It was insane.
Yeah.
But I love German weddings. I just am, you know, not as young as I used to be. Can't really appreciate them the way that I did.
You don't have the decades of practice and like getting ready for that.
And you need to plan ahead.
Oh yeah.
But it's a delightful family. And mm-hmm. I have to say, I feel very fortunate to have been welcomed in, and extremely fortunate, like weird, bizarre set of circumstances where at least I had a foundation mm-hmm. with the language before becoming a part of that extended family. It really is true that it doesn't, like, I've sadly let it languish a lot, but it goes a long way having a basic facility with the language and making the effort. Mm-hmm. What I have seen over the, you know, the 30 years or so that we've been going there, is particular in Berlin. Berlin has changed from a city where, first of all, it helped to speak German, to then, well, it didn't really matter whether you spoke German or English, to now where it's preferentially English.
Yeah.
It's super weird. Like, it's really legitimately strange to walk into a coffee shop in Berlin and before you say anything, be asked what your order is in English. Mm-hmm. It's bizarre.
It is. I have some friends that have, like, some expats in like Germany. They've complained about that a little bit, that like they want to learn the language and everybody insists on speaking English now.
It is the sixth borough of New York City. Like, it's mm-hmm. It's like you carved off some of Brooklyn and took it to Europe. And I don't mind, because I live in Brooklyn and I mm-hmm. like it here. So I'm happy when I go to Berlin. But it is one of the weirder things in my experience to have that specificity of mm-hmm. experience that I'm sure that was true of, you know, Paris in the 1950s. Like, wherever there's a large American community, mm-hmm. there's going to be this sort of Englishification, and that's okay, I guess. But it's a combination of like the expat community, the artistic community, and the startup community
yeah.
in Berlin
yeah.
that has just, it went it's gone way over to that side. Mm-hmm. And it to be noticeable enough for somebody who shows up for a week every other year to see it happen and to mm-hmm. witness it happening, that to me is amazing. Like, yeah. I'm just like, wow. My first visit to Berlin in May of 1990 was when there was still an East Germany.
Yeah.
And when there was still a Grenze, the wall was down, but I had an American passport. We couldn't just walk across. We had mm-hmm. to go to Checkpoint Charlie. And where when we rode the U-Bahn, we were riding on the subway in Berlin, and we got to the Alexanderplatz station and continued on. And our host, Trudy Katayan of blessed memory, said, "You don't know how weird this is, because for decades, this train has stopped here and they made everybody get off. And then mm-hmm. it would like ghost train on across the border. But now it's just going through." And it's like everybody on the train was like, "This is super freaky." We're like, "Oh, this just seems normal." But yeah. that was the first time I ever mm-hmm. went to Berlin. It was May of 1990. And then to be there in, you know, 2018 or yeah. 2019.
Very different city. Like,
very different. Yeah, so
very different.
Different
city.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to jump back a little bit in history. I kind of wonder about like your upbringing. I mean, you said like a Jewish upbringing. Was it very traditional or was it more like Reformed Jewish?
It was not very traditional. We went to synagogue and we observed mm-hmm. the holidays, but it was reform. Mm-hmm. We went to a Reform synagogue. My mother grew up Reform. My father grew up conservative. Mm-hmm. So his parents definitely kept kosher and were a little more traditional. But it was the tradition of our home. Mm-hmm. And we often would light candles on Friday evening, and we definitely, you know, okay. we had big Passover celebrations and so forth. So that's been my lifelong experience. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely, of course, a lot of food associated with that.
That's what I wanted to ask, because I mean, my wife just like is in the process of converting. And one thing I have observed, and I don't know whether it's true or not, is that food seems to be very, very important.
Like it is.
Play a really important role. So I'm kind of curious, like what do you remember, what you grew up with?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. I think if you ask a lot of, well, I'm not going to talk about other people. I'm going to talk about me. So I definitely have strong memories of Passover mm-hmm. From when I was a kid. And Passover is one of those holidays that has it has an inescapable culinary component. Like other holidays, mm-hmm. you could sort of, depending on what you want to do or what, you know, what specific part of the Jewish world and Jewish culture you come from, you could have very, very different experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's really true for in the distinction between the Eastern European Ashkenazi mm-hmm. Jewish tradition and the Central Asia or Southern Europe tradition of Sephardim, mm-hmm. Very different cuisines and actually very different holiday observances as well. But Passover, pretty much everybody's going to have one thing in common, which is the absence of leaven mm-hmm. and the presence of matzah. So when I was a kid, one of the things that I always enjoyed was at the Passover Seder, when my grandfather and my uncle were usually the people who led it. And then we would get to the part of the Seder. The Seder is one of the few times in Jewish practice or Jewish tradition where there is a prescribed, not only is there prescribed food, but there is a prescribed sandwich. Mm-hmm. And that is the Hillel sandwich. So the ritual foods on the Passover table include maror, which is horseradish or bitter herbs, and usually in the form of whole root or grated horseradish, which is of course very clears the sinuses and is very spicy.
Oh yeah.
Matzah, which is that flat unleavened mm-hmm. bread, cracker-like bread, and choroset, which is a sweet paste usually made with apples and walnuts and wine. And it is traditional, and it's actually articulated in the Haggadah, in the Seder order, mm-hmm. Or in the practice of the ritual meal. It is traditional to eat those three things together, is to eat the horseradish, the choroset, and the matzah all together. It's called a Hillel sandwich. It is delicious. Yep. And so
I've had it. So yeah.
Oh, it's really yummy. Yeah. And depending the fun part for me now is that it's possible sometimes to get it's like surprise Doritos. Sometimes you get horseradish that is ridiculously hot and people aren't expecting it. And so everybody will put a glop on their Hillel sandwich and take a bite and like watch their heads explode across the table. It's amazing. But that was always a memory I had as a child of like, oh, this is going to be an extreme experience or you're eating something that may make you uncomfortable, but you're doing it because it's specifically to form memories. Mm-hmm. The entire Seder is about generational communication and telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And so if you're going to do that, you should have memorable food. So we're going to do that. We're going to have parsley that we dip, and we're going to have the matzah, and we're going to have the Hillel sandwich, and we're going to have matzah ball soup, which is yummy. And we're going to have, you know, these traditional foods are going to make their way into the meal. So that was something we did every year. In terms of home cooking, it wasn't especially like, it didn't seem to have a particularly Jewish flavor. My mother did make my grandmother's brisket and other dishes, but it was really when we were with my grandparents, my father's parents, that we were exposed to, you know, a broader spectrum of Jewish foods. My grandmother was an amazing cook, my grandma Mickey, and she was also an amazing baker. Mm-hmm. And so her baked goods were ridiculous. And she would make cookies, she'd make coconut cake, and she made apricot bars, which were a like a blondie style cookie bar with a shortbread. It wasn't really a shortbread layer, but then oats and apricot preserves. So delicious. After she died, the recipe was lost for many years. And even then, once we recovered the recipe, which was like written in longhand in the side of a newspaper clipping in a folder, nobody could really quite replicate, as they often are, nobody could really replicate the experience of it until my daughter and her cousin teamed up and tried it. And because Shoshi, my younger daughter, is an amazing baker, she's like, I think I need to blind bake this crust, this lower crust, a little bit, and see if I give it a little bit more structure. And it finally came out in a way that triggered the sense memory. Like, ooh, that's it.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Like if you ask, like, especially those grandma recipes, like even if they're written down, they're never complete.
Nope.
Like they
always
just
left out something.
Yeah, they just do it from memory. Like they've been doing it for so long. They're like, even if they try to write it down, they don't remember all the steps because it's just an automatic thing that they just do. So like I have recipes for my grandma, and it took me a long time to replicate them too, because same thing. Like she didn't mention half of the things she did. Like in some cases I remembered and I knew because I had cooked it with her, and I was like, okay, yeah, I know, like she just wrote like one thing here, but it's like seven steps. So, okay, I know that, but it takes a while, and sometimes it's sad. On the other hand, I think that's kind of the magic of a grandmother, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems very clear that in the second half of the 20th century, there was a gap in knowledge transfer in a lot of ways between the previous generation and the next generation, because people weren't living in multi-generational contexts the same way they had been for the prior, you know, 200, 300 years, or longer. And so if you didn't make a specific effort to do that transfer, stuff got dropped.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you know, my grandmother did leave a lot of her recipes written down. She also participated in fundraising cookbooks for synagogues or JCCs. So she would contribute a lot of her recipes. And in fact, she would contribute a lot of her recipes and then credit them to her daughters-in-law or her nieces. So you see all these recipes that are like, there's recipes in this cookbook from Jacksonville, Florida that are attributed to my mom that she never made that, but it was my grandmother's recipe that she's like, oh, put it under her name. So yeah, we have a lot of that. I mean, I think that I, I was, you know, you talk about food memories from the religious experience. The cultural side of it is that one of the things I loved when I was a kid was on Saturday mornings going with my dad to Bagel Nosh, which was the bagel chain of bagel stores in New York at the time, it was the 1970s. And so we would walk a few blocks over to Bagel Nosh and we would wait in line. And my dad would order, you know, a dozen bagels and a half a pound of scallion cream cheese and a half a pound of lox. And we'd go home and he would thin slice the Bermuda onion. I got to talk to him and find out how he does that, because I'm very bad at slicing onions. But he would thin slice the Bermuda onion and thin slice the tomato and the capers. And then, you know, and brunch on Saturday would be bagels and lox.
Yeah.
And that was consistent across years. Mm-hmm. And so I love a bagel and lox. I had one. Did I have one today? No, I had one yesterday. I had one yesterday for lunch. I love bagels and lox. I've always loved bagels and lox. I will, you know, I'll eat them at any opportunity.
Yeah.
My wife, who is an ordained rabbi, not a huge fan. She's not her favorite thing. And my children don't like lox on bagels. And I feel I feel like, you know, I talked earlier about their adventurous palates. I feel like this is a cultural gap where I've got to go back. It's like, oh, well, no, but you need to, people won't believe that you are a Jewish kid from Brooklyn if you don't eat this. And they're like, no.
It's true, yeah.
We got plenty of street cred. We don't need that.
Yeah. Bagels is one of those things that, like, has, I think, to some extent, transcended, like, the culture, and also New York is just, like, as a place. It's everywhere. I mean, I don't even remember how I learned about bagels, but I do remember that I ordered them from a place like a bakery in Berlin. because, like, I mean, they were hard to get in, like, where I was, but they delivered them. So I would order, like, whatever, 48 bagels and then just freeze them. Funny thing, I like, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was craving bagels, and you can't get them here. You can get the really bad ones that you get at supermarkets. I made bagels. I made bagels this week. New York style, like, everything bagels. I started doing them again because, like, I was craving them. I don't do them with lox. I'm not a big fan of lox.
That's okay. You're but not like
cream cheese, but cream cheese and tomatoes, a little bit of cheese usually.
I would. That's an Instagram live I would watch. By the way, is your bagel making? I think like one of the culinary questions I've always been curious about, like, is there a definitive answer? Is why the bread products of New York City, specifically bagels and pizza, but also maybe some other pastries as well, but like bagels and pizza particularly, why they don't taste the same other places. And this is interesting too, because there's Montreal bagels, which are delicious, but don't taste the same as New York City bagels.
I mean, there's Chicago pizza, and it's definitely
the Chicago pizza. Chicago pizza is great. There's good pizza other places, but it doesn't taste like New York pizza.
Yep.
I'm not going to say there's good bagels other places, but there's acceptable bagels other places. Tell you someplace you can't get a bagel for love or money and enjoy it is Israel, which is super disappointing. Their bagels are bad. The cuisine of Israel is a whole other thing and another place I've spent a lot of time. But the experience of a New York City bagel and then trying to figure out, was it the water? Like, what exactly is going on here? My best guess is it's the mineral content of the tap water that is creating that specific set of circumstances, that alchemy that you need to have the proper crust, but still the slightly doughy, soft inside, and it not be too flat, not be too puffy, not be too round, like this. It's not easy.
No, it's not. As I can tell you, it is.
Yeah.
It's, you're probably right. It's probably the water. It's probably a little bit also environment, like air and so on, like that has an influence.
Or the wild yeast.
Mm-hmm.
is also relevant too. It's not simply something that you can replicate from a recipe. It says water. It's like, okay, but what kind? And this is, I mean, this
even
is
flour.
Like the same.
Like it starts with a flour. Like there are like 17 million different kinds of flour. Like it's like, that's the thing. I found a YouTube video from a guy in New York who made New York bagels. Mm-hmm. And I followed it. And I'm like, doesn't work. My flour is different. Water is different. I'm still working out the ingredients, like how much water, what flour I'm using here. Like the yeast is different. Like everything is different. You're absolutely right.
I wonder how much of it is just like, it's like Belgian beer. Mm. That if you don't have the actual microbes, the same microbes that have been growing in the same swamp for thousands of years, if you don't have those in the air, you can't make the thing.
Yeah.
Like you just can't. You can't replicate. You would have what you would have to do is get a tank full of the air and bring the air with you.
Well, you could do that,
which is not a bad idea. I wonder if, like, you know, bring a tank of New York air. I should start selling New York air.
Oh, you should.
Thought,
but I don't think that's that important. Like, I think you can make good bagels, and they're not New York bagels, but they can still be good. Like it doesn't mean that they have to be bad. They're just different, which is fine. Like it's as you said, it's like pizza.
Like
there's a big difference between New York pizza and like whatever Southern Italy pizza.
Oh my god!
Even within Italy, they're like, every city has their own kind of pizza. So
that's someplace I'm sad I've never been. I've had a number of opportunities to go to Italy, and it's never quite panned out.
You should.
And I should, and we were talking before the recording started. We lost a member of the family this week. My stepfather, Robert Perlman, who lived in Italy from when he was 20 to maybe 23 or 24, and that informed his, you know, culinary interests and his palate for the rest of his life.
Yeah, definitely.
Into, you know, he died at the age of 81, and for that entire time, like, there were things that just weren't any good if you weren't in Italy. Mm-hmm. And he drank Montepulciano, and he loved to make veal parmesan, and like, and his one of his favorite restaurants, and another place that was a culinary memory from my childhood, was an Italian restaurant in New York City that I don't think exists anymore. It was called Il Vagabondo, and it was a ground level. It was like you walked down the sidewalk into this place on the east side, and they had, you know, Fellini-esque photographs, black and white photographs on the walls of pasta, and it was loud, and they had a bar, but at the back of the bar, there was a bocce court. Mm-hmm. So people would go and they'd take their drink and they'd wait for the food to be ready and they'd play bocce. But just delicious veal, delicious chicken, and filet limone, which was, I always enjoyed there. Mm-hmm. And he'd always come in and he'd order the veal parmigiana. That was his thing. A person and a place no longer with us, Bob Perlman and Il Vagabondo, both well remembered.
Mm-hmm. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it's definitely. I have friends in Italy, and I've been a couple of times, and it's definitely one of my favorite memories, to be honest.
I gotta go. That's on my post pandemic list, is to go. And you know, it's of all the places I have been, I think German cuisine and Israeli cuisine have big roles, but I got to say that New Zealand was probably my favorite culinary destination.
Ooh, okay.
Because it was a lot of flavor. We went there in 2000 on our honeymoon, and it was a lot of flavors that, you know, that I had never experienced. Just like amazing lamb and amazing produce and herbs, and also fantastic wine. Holy cow. Just, you know, just everything tasted good. And I don't know if it's because we were young and in love and on the other side of the planet, but everything tasted really good. I was really
probably didn't hurt,
it.
I would say.
Didn't hurt. Didn't make things taste worse.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely a place to go to. If you need recommendations for Italy, let me know. Like, I have friends there.
So. I will. I'll tell you that an Italian dish is my single favorite dish to make and eat is an Italian dish, which is hot cherry pepper pork chops, which I had in a restaurant in Philadelphia 17 years ago. And it was another one of those culinary experiences that it was on the verge of being painful. It was right up to the edge of like too intense to actually enjoy. But it's pork chops sauteed with garlic, mm-hmm. hot cherry peppers, and the vinegar from the cherry peppers. And it's so simple to make, mm-hmm. but it is absolutely freaking delicious. And it's so, and I do make it pretty hot, and it's hot enough that only one of my children will eat it, which is a good line. It's like, mm-hmm. if you can turn off at least one person, mm-hmm. but it's fantastic. And it mm-hmm. is really, it's like, I'm doing this because I know I'm going to have a specific experience when I eat it. And I'm really looking forward to that. So I will drive forward with it. I love it.
When you mentioned that just reminded me of, I used to make, well, let's call it Chinese inspired food because it definitely wasn't Chinese food, but it was inspired. That only me and our cat could eat. It was so spicy that nobody in the family could eat it other than the cat. She loved
Ouch.
It. I don't know why. The cat loved it. Like,
that's bizarre. I've never made anything that my cat really enjoyed. So maybe I'm not going far enough afield.
Probably.
But that's great.
That's amazing.
Well, I've taken up so much of your time. Is there any last question that we want to cover?
I have a list. You will have to come back. I have a list.
Okay. Good.
There is one thing because you mentioned it earlier, like that you like kitchen gadgets, and I wanted to know what is the worst or the most useless kitchen gadget you've bought.
Wow. The worst or the most useless. I'll go with the one I've bought more varieties of to no particular purpose, which was a few years ago. I had a bout of buying garlic peelers, mm-hmm. or things to peel garlic with. And the one that I bought that was particularly useless was like this round rubber cylinder where you'd put the garlic cloves inside and then press it down on the countertop and roll it back and forth. Mm-hmm. Didn't really work. And I've since discovered that the best way to peel garlic is either to smash it, yep. or crack it with the knife on the cutting board, which is great. Or you can put garlic cloves in a screw top jar, mm-hmm. close the lid and shake the jar for 10 seconds. And the garlic peels will come right off. Mm-hmm. And if I'd known any of these tricks, like technique wise, mm-hmm. I never would have bought all the garlic peelers. But I bought enough garlic peelers that my wife made fun of me for buying too many garlic peelers. So
the fact that you bought more than one is funny.
I know, it's weird. And you know, like garlic presses and mm-hmm. garlic, you know, garlic whatever's. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love garlic. I might go, you know, just make a bagna cauda. You know, right now when we get mm-hmm. off the phone, because I love it and I'll eat it anytime, day or night. But I am not much with the peeling of it. I gotta get better at that.
Well, it's just something that I thought of when you mentioned kitchen gadgets, because there's stuff out there that you can buy, and I've done it. And then you think about it and like, yeah, why did I buy this? Like, I never, ever used it.
There was no point. There was no point. It's true. And sometimes they're expensive, mm-hmm. And you regret it sooner than you would otherwise.
I have the one that I remember is it's kind of a julienne peeler. Mm-hmm. You can like peel really like thin slices of whatever, carrots or whatever. I still have it. I've never used it in like 10 years. It has moved across the ocean. Twice already, God. And I still haven't used it.
Not ideal.
So it wasn't ideal expensive, so that's the only good thing. All right, Mike, thank you so much for doing this. I have so many notes, so I will have to do some research and find all the links for it. You definitely have to come back. There's like so many questions.
I would be glad to. It's been a pleasure, and it's delightful to see you again after so much time, and yeah. Also to talk about the wide range of culinarily associated topics. Some were a little far afield from some of them, but you know, there's never not a way to connect things
absolutely.
To food.
We've covered a lot of ground. Like, I mean, it definitely went completely different direction than I thought, which is what this show is, really. Like, there's like, I have an idea what I'm going to talk about. It never pans out because that's not what the show is about. It's not about me. It's about you. So that's why.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Tell the good people where they can find you.
You can find me on Twitter at Mike T. Rose. You can find me on the aforementioned After Show, which is aftershowpodcast.com or the_aftershow on Twitter. And you can find me sometimes on Chuck Joyner's Mac Voices Live, which records live every Tuesday afternoon. And finally, at this week in particular, you can find me on Ken Ray's In a Few Minutes, which you can, I believe, is linked off macosken.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will put the links in the show notes, so everything to find here. I'm not going to lie, I have like 20 links at least, so.
well, who knew we were going to end up back in northwestern Germany, but that's where we did.
I learned something. I didn't even know that you like we're in that region. I knew that you were in Germany, but like I had no clue where. So yeah,
it's funny. It's well, there's a song. It's like, you know, everywhere you go, the Lippischer folks are there. Mm-hmm. Or die Lippe, sie sind da. And the first time I heard that song, I was like, oh, that's a fun little tune about, you know, being from this particular region. And then I later found out, as we did on this very podcast, that it's literally true.
Yeah, it is.
That this is a part of the world where people have exploded outward in mm-hmm. many directions. And there's a lot of expats and people who've traced their roots back to this part of northwestern Germany.
Absolutely.
So they're not kidding around with the songs. Nope. Like everywhere nope. you go.
Absolutely not. Thank you so much for being here, Mike. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. If you want to find the show notes and everything, head over to foodieflashback.com/ that should be episode number 19, I think. So /19. You will find all the other episodes, all the fun people I've talked to. And if you want to be on the show like Mike, then just reach out to me. Either there's a contact form on the website or at Foodie Flashback on Twitter. I don't think I'm on Instagram yet. And maybe I should go on that. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.